coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly.
Welcome back to Worth Doing Badly with me, Jamie Krieger, and also David Weber at the other end of the telephone line. David, welcome back.
It's good to hear from you, Jamie.
It's nice to hear your voice. So we are talking about the third Sunday in Advent on this episode. And the lessons are Isaiah 35, verses 1 through 10, Psalm 146, James chapter 5, verses 7 through 11, and the Gospel is from Matthew 11, verses 2 to 15. Now, beginning with the Gospel lesson, Jesus is very emphatic about the necessity of hearing and seeing here, or seeing through hearing. What is Jesus talking about in this lesson?
Well, once again, we prepare for Christmas with this very strange man, John, and with a really strong message of repentance. And when John is preaching, not everyone can hear what he has to say and receive it. And the Bible doesn't give us enough information as to what distinguishes the people who go out to the wilderness because he has touched something. They have not been driven out to the wilderness. They have been drawn by something that John has said. And then there are others who go to John because they hear in his voice a call to freedom that they find threatening. And they are the people who live in the palaces and are the fashionable people. And so we've got this really interesting passage in front of us where we can ask the question, why is the same message to some attractive and life-giving, and that exact same message is something which they feel threatened by? And it's not as if these are two different people. As I read this, I am both of those characters. Sometimes I am open to this message, and other times I am resistant to it. So I'm able to read this passage as doing a bit of digging around in my own life and wondering about my relationship to John's message of repentance. And I like the fact that the crowd that is drawn to this message, and I want to stress that most of the time we think of some repentance as something we drive other people to. John doesn't say it that way. John goes away from everybody else. No one has to pay any attention, so that if, in fact, they want to hear what he has to say, they must freely go out there, one foot in front of the other, and put themselves into a position where they can hear what John has to say. And I think that in the wilderness of the modern church today, this is a wonderful opportunity for people to hear the message, not because they're driven to it, not because they're manipulated by it, but because they are drawn to the message of repentance. Well, what is that message that's drawing this diverse crowd out to the wilderness to hear John? It's the message that somehow we are all in need of repentance. No matter who we are, no matter what we've accomplished, no matter what people think of us, either for good or for ill, repentance makes us all equals before God. And in fact, Jesus says, those who hear the message of repentance are even greater than the greatest prophet, who is John. So in a sense, repentance turns every human relationship on its head. And what really matters is not what other people are thinking or doing or accomplishing. What matters is the single individual standing before God in repentance in order to receive the gift of forgiveness that God gives. Now, all other things are important. They're just not as important as this moment in which the person is standing before God saying, I come with nothing. I only come to receive. They hear in John's strange message a promise that allows them to relax. Now, the fashionable and the powerful can't hear that message. John says they're in a special collection of people who are brood of vipers. They live so much by deception and making advances and making things secure for themselves by this deception that they are more predatory than they are at peace. And Jesus says John's message of repentance shows what makes us as human beings really special. It's not our zip code. It's not the clothes we wear. It's not what we eat. What makes us special is our relationship with God. Now, we hear that 1,000 times, but when we actually see how that message irritates the people who want to be special for other reasons, we have to admire how important that message is. Maybe not admire, just stand back and be in awe that something that we've heard over and over again, this message of repentance, could actually be such a fundamental truth that those who don't like it finally have to silence it. It is a great benefit that John was finally, he had to have his head removed from his body because the words that other people were hearing had to be stopped. I'm not sure any of us recognize the power of this message of repentance because we've heard it so often until we see that others hear that and find it to be a really dangerous thing. Now, what makes it so dangerous? It's that John really doesn't want to start a movement or create a following. Rather, he wants to get a truth across. And whether that truth gets across to a few or to many, John is not interested, and so he essentially puts God to the test and says, I'm going to preach this message, but I'm going to go where there aren't any people, and we will see if the people come to the message. If your message is as beautiful as I have found it to be, John seems to be saying, if it is as inspiring and life-changing as it has been for me, then I will be able to go to the barren wilderness, and that message will ring out with the message with a promise of life. And so John goes to where there's raw deprivation, and wherever there is raw deprivation, there you have the most profound hunger and thirst. And I think that's what's missing from our world today. People have so much. The one thing they don't have is hunger and thirst. And John satisfies it with what I take to be a rather gross diet. Honey, wild honey is okay, but not locust and not combined with wine. And yet, with those little foretastes, that's the stuff of the desert, with those little foretastes, John is filled with gratitude because, not because it's the eternal feast, but because it gives him a taste of the eternal feast. Now, the interesting, this contrasts with the palace. The palace is filled with every good material thing that can be purchased. It has everything, except it doesn't have gratitude because it doesn't have hunger. It is a place of insatiable lust and anger, but it is not a place where that emptiness can ever be satisfied. And so John's, what seems to be a life-denying message of repentance actually opens up the world of eternity to those people who recognize that their deepest desires cannot be satisfied in this life. And so John goes to, it speaks to all the people in this world who have tried all the shoddy and disappointing substitutes for eternity. And he says, those substitutes will never displace eternity, but they will point you to where what you desire can be satisfied. Now, John eventually gets to Herod's pleasure palace. And as I said, there was nothing missing from Herod's pleasure palace except satisfaction. And the one time that there was satisfaction in the pleasure palace is when John was there incarcerated in the prison. And John wondered, is Jesus the one? There is something about being stuck in a prison, about to be executed, that you want to believe that the promise that you have lived by is a promise that you can still trust. And what Jesus says to John's disciples is, just report to John what you see. That where this message goes out, people who have been deprived of certain aspects of life, the lame, the blind, the hungry, the dead, those people who are deprived do not remain in that deprivation. Where there is this promise, that promise is working to bring life, and it sometimes brings it in rather startling ways, in miracles. But for most of us, this life comes to us over the course of time as we are built up to trust Jesus by his word. So once again, I go back to this, Jamie, in saying that, you and I have preached this for our whole life. It can tend to lose its appeal or its attractiveness because of this repetition. And so when we see the reaction of the people that finally had to behead John, we recognize again that this message is life-changing because it opens up eternity to everyone. And that means that each of us in our relationship to God is of more value, of more importance, of more significance than anything else that can happen here on earth. So that takes us then to the psalm in which, again, the psalmist in a beautiful way says, it's easy to put your trust in princes. And what is it that princes actually do in order to get your trust? You know, when God was trying to persuade Israel not to have a king, but rather to organize himself differently, he said, when you finally do have a king, you'll recognize that, yes, there's someone that's right there in the midst of you that is concrete, which is a little bit easier than actually trusting God to work through the prophets and the priests. But you'll find out that the king likes being king, likes to be the most important person in the world, and you'll find that the king takes a lot of your resources, but really doesn't have much power to fulfill the promises that a king seems to make. And so here in the psalm it says, Israel has had several kings now, well into this, the psalm itself says, don't trust in these people. Yeah, you have a king, you got what you want. Yeah, you have princes and royal family, but guess what? They will not do for you what you think they will do, because they cannot provide you with the salvation that your soul desires. And you know this because they die. And what does their death tell you? His plans perish. Now, we have bureaucrats. We have people that say, elect me and I will fulfill all of your desires. Now, these people are important, not because they can fulfill our desires. It's because they can fill in the potholes in the road and keep a certain level of order and keep just laws. They cannot do, at least in America, the promises that politicians make. You would have to be greater than God to actually fulfill them. What they actually do is they have meetings. They make plans. And these plans don't almost never actually go into take shape. And in fact, most of the times the plans backfire in some big way. So this psalm, you can see why, if John had this psalm nearby, you can see why the people who make all the plans and think they have all the power, why they would not like this. And the psalm then says, you want to know what real power is. Real power sets prisoners free. Real power opens the eyes of the blind. Real power can lift up the bowed down and go to the sojourners and uphold the widow. That's where real power is. But the thing is, you don't see it as real power because that power is hanging around prisoners and hanging around the blind and hanging around the bowed down and the sojourners and the widow. They are going to the place of deprivation because there is trust that the power in this promise can change these people's lives. The people who are powerful don't have time for this. for these kinds of people. They are too busy making their plans and having their meetings. And so this psalm recognizes that if we want to know what a meaningful life is, it's embodied in a person like John the Baptist. It's embodied in a person that goes to the prisons, that works among the blind, that is available for those who are crushed by life or who lack roots. All of these things are where real life takes place. Now, why is this? Because as Ecclesiastes says, we have eternity residing in our heart. We want a life that is everlasting. And that kind of powerful life, you know it's powerful if it can take those people who have been deprived of life and begin to give them hope that their past is not indicative of the potential that they have when they live their lives in the presence of God. So once again, the Psalms is saying to us, you know, when you sing in worship, it doesn't look like much is going on. And in fact, as we've said before, worship is becoming more and more a marginal thing in our culture because it doesn't look like anything important is taking place. But these songs that we sing in worship, they actually are prophetic messages of the life that we expect God to deliver on because God has made these promises to us. And so the psalm says you can either live by these promises or you can live by the irrelevant plans that the powerful make and rarely accomplish. Now, that takes us to the book of Isaiah. Now, Jamie, I have to say, somewhere along the line, I would like to be able to pronounce it as you do, Isaiah, but that sounds, again, too uppity to me.
It takes some practice.
With the inferior pronunciation. Unless somehow you could get me a pass that I would be able to pronounce it that way. Or maybe I should just wait and let you, I'll say the next verse is, and then you chime in, Isaiah 35. So, we should try something like that.
Sounds like a plan. Let's do this then. We move on to Isaiah, and here we
so much more, it sounds so much better than when I say it.
And yeah. Here we hear of parched soil and sterile conditions turning into lush vegetation. What is that all about?
You know, if any of us were trying to pick a home and asked the real estate to take us to places that look like Isaiah is talking about, the real estate agent would say, no, you don't understand. When you reside somewhere, you want it to be filled with all the things that, all the comforts and pleasures. And it seems like these texts are saying that people who live for comfort and pleasure aren't very interesting. You already know what to expect from them. But people who are strangely attracted to the wilderness will find a gladness there that they could not have anticipated. What is that gladness? As you had pointed out, it is the rejoicing that happens in the desert when the crocus comes up. Now, I don't know about the deserts, but I've lived a good share of my life in Montana and have spent a lot of time in the mountains. And the first plant, at least in my experience, that would come up in the spring, oftentimes breaking through the snow, would be the crocus. The crocus would be the one sign that spring was coming. And in fact, people would say to those who had been walking in the mountains, have you seen any blooming crocuses? And it was a sense of anticipation and joy that would take place when the crocuses would begin to bloom. That is the kind of world that God has planted us in. It is a world in which if the wilderness really has embedded in it the potentiality of a crocus, you don't see it, but when it comes forth, all of a sudden, you are surprised. Those who live for pleasure and for their own comfort or whatever, nothing is surprising about their life. A world in which what Isaiah sees is that we are continually surprised that God keeps his promises and that we see this glory not in palaces, not in abundance, but in a tiny single plant that breaks through the snow. And that is what God calls his glory. That's why John declares the glory of God in the wilderness, because it is a sign of the potentiality. Now, who is open to this message? Isaiah says, those who have an anxious heart. No, that's most of us. Those who have recognized that for all of their efforts, the things that they desire the most still seem elusive. It would be very hard to have been Herod, like it would have been hard to be Mick Jagger, I suppose, that you try to get satisfaction, and you try, and you try, and you try, and it never happens. Now, if you turn it into a rock song, you can make millions of dollars off that lack of satisfaction, or should I say millions of pounds, but there's something desperate, that the trying and the trying never stops, and Isaiah says, no, the anxious heart actually will be satisfied by God keeping his promises. So all we can do is that we can voice the promise. You know, that's sometimes preaching is just so, it just feels like it's so impotent and lacking power, because all we can do is voice the promise, be strong and fear not. And then we just have to sit and wait to see if God comes through. We have to sit and wait if God provides the means of strength and God deals with the anxiety. And we're just not quite content with it. We say, okay, I'll say the promise, but I'd kind of like to have a plan in place. I'd kind of like to have a program that I could point people to. I would like to have something more going on rather than saying, we are going to be the kind of people that want to be capable of hearing that promise. We want to be like John and be able to say to God, are you the one to come, or should we be looking for another? And then be stuck in our prisons and wait for God to show himself to us. And so what the world calls glory, what the world calls the things that draw attention to it, that's not God's way. God says if you want to really see glory, go out into the wilderness and sit patiently. And there you will see what's glorious is the fact that God can start with nothing and create a universe. And that God can take the nothingness that we offer him, our anxious hearts, and turn that into strength and fearlessness. But it requires of us to just wait in patience, and there's probably nothing more difficult than that kind of waiting. In fact, the ancient people who thought a lot about virtue thought that the virtue of courage was most manifested when you had to wait in patience. It doesn't look like courage because it's not doing anything. It's just waiting for the promise to run its natural course. And that takes us to James, and we agree on the pronunciation of James. And in James, he asks a question essentially. Why do we admire Job when being like Job is so difficult and those who are like Job are so rare? And yet we talk about Job as an admirable character. It's because he is associated with patience. It was a rather talkative patience. It was a patience that Job waited for God to act while talking to his so-called friends and trying to figure out why God was so slow in acting. It's the kind of patience that is what I think is at the heart and center of education. Education is essentially waiting for these promises to materialize while reading and asking questions and pondering these things. So Job essentially is a book about what it means to be educated in trying to have a question answered. Why am I suffering? And not letting go of that question until you get it adequately answered. That is the spirit of education. You don't drive people to get educated. A true liberal free education is of people who are drawn to this because there are questions that they have to have answered. All right, so back to this whole sense of our impatience and Job. If we look at the farmer as James tells us to do, an impatient farmer is one who is always angry and anxious. In fact, if a farmer is impatient, he will not be a farmer for very long, because you cannot have real growth without letting things run their course. Now, there are such things as unreal growth, cancer and cheap pleasure. They grow quickly. It's like the grass. It grows quickly and it withers. But the things that grow, that continue to grow, that the things that are edifying by repetition, that continue to build us up, they work very slowly and they take time. And for anybody who has tried to farm, between the planting and the harvesting, when there's a lot of work, there is not much you can do. You have to really hope and pray that a large number of things outside of your control do go right. And this is why in agricultural communities, the table prayer is not just a mantra that you say in order to get to the food. A table prayer really does acknowledge that so many things had to go right in order for that food that's before you to be there. And no one knows that better than the farmer who year in and year out has to wait for God to act for the produce to take place. And it's those times of drought or the times of famine that the farmer will remember. Yes, so this makes us more grateful for the times when things actually do work out. And most of the time, things do work out. That when you have suffered through the time when things have not worked out, it makes you realize just how dependent that we are on nature working. And so James says, why be patient? Because it's natural. You couldn't eat a morsel of food unless the farmer was patient. The most basic thing that sustains our life, food, is an act which is an act of patience. And so what James then says is, then let's work on that. That's a lifelong work. All of us can be more patient than we are. All of us can be more loving, as patience is the first corollary of loving. And so this is a task that will never end. And James is not berating us. He is not scolding us into being patient. In other words, all of these texts have been drawing us into the beauty of this patience. And so I asked the question again with Job: why do we admire Job when patience is so difficult for us? And the answer to that is that those around Job are the ones who benefited from his patience. Job did not like being afflicted, but the fact that he, in his affliction, used that time in order to plumb the depths of God's wisdom has served every person that has read the book of Job and has been lifted up out of their despair by that book. Every person is very happy that Job was a patient person and that he used his time of affliction in such a fruitful way. So we may not like the fact that we have to be patient, but those around us will very much appreciate and give thanks to God for that gift of patience. That again brings us back to the Advent preparation for Christmas, in which God gives us this crazy character of John and his message of repentance and says, you want to be really ready for Christmas? Here is how you do it. You have hearts that cannot wait for the coming of Christ's incarnation, where where life is opened up. And that leads us to this last image of John stuck in that prison in despair. Somewhere along the line, John's disciples report back to him, and it turns that prison, which was seemed to be the dead end of John's life, into a portal into eternity. He was not incarcerated. He was being liberated through the things that would now take place in his life.
Thank you once again very much, David, for helping us look at these lessons as we prepare for Sunday, both pastors in writing their sermons and also our listeners as they prepare their hearing to see the wonders of Christmas for which we are being prepared. So thank you once again. This brings us to the end of it, and we will talk again next week when we will look at the lessons for the fourth Sunday in Advent.